Welcome to Speak Up International with Rita Burke and Elton Brown.
Now, almost everyone that we have spoken with on Speak Up International have mentioned this guest's name. As a matter of fact, they have all suggested that we invite you to chat with us on Speak Up International. I know for a fact that those people recognize, much like I do, the value that you have added and continue to add to our community and ultimately to Canada and the world. Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Akua Benjamin. Dr. Akua Benjamin is definitely a community builder and a longtime activist. She was an educator and administrator at the Toronto Metropolitan University. Dr. Benjamin has also been a social worker her whole life in both formal and informal capacities. Dr. Benjamin, it is certainly a pleasure to have you on Speak Up International.
I thank you very much, first of all, for the work, Rita and Elton, that you're doing in the community, because there are not many people who are doing this work, who are capturing the struggles, the history, the background, and what, as we all know, what tends to happen, there is sometimes when we do this work, it's because something has happened. There normally, and it's not a good thing that has happened, like there is a shooting, there is something terrible that has happened, and then we get highlighted on in that context as a Black community. Then reporters come in, we have people who want to take our history, we're engaged with government. So the profile gets raised. And then there is a response usually by the powers that be, and then everything gets silent again. A lot of people are still doing the work, but it seems as though the work has died. So the work that you both have undertaken to arrest that kind of process is really important to capture, not just from me, but from others who've been engaged in the work of struggling against racism, inequities, discrimination. And that's a history. Mm-hmm. That didn't begin recently. That from the time, I always say, from the time the slaves landed on the shores of North America, they've been resistance. So that the capturing some of that from people like me, I think should be, and I know you will, put it in that context of the continuation of the voices of resistance or the work of resistance that you're both undertaking.
We are so excited to have you here with us and a pleasure meeting you. And we want to have a conversation with you, Dr. Benjamin, about your career, views on social work, and your role as a leader in this field. What inspired you to pursue a career in social work? And how did your interest in community development and human rights play a role?
Okay, I want you, when I get too verbose, to really cut me off or to tell me that's enough. Tell me, because once you ask me that question about what drew you into social work, for instance, I go right back to my history. I go back to my grandparents, I go back to particularly my mother. And my parents came, both of them came from a little island called Antigua in the Caribbean. And they're coming out of colonialism and all of that. My grandfather used to burn coals for a living. And my mother used to have to take the bundle of coals, hot coals, and they're wrapped in what we call then a crocus bag, a burlap bag, you would say. And she'd had to walk from 4 miles from where they lived to the market for them to sell. And one of the days that she was walking with this bag of coals, the coals would not, they were still lit. And so the bag burst into flames on her head, carrying this coal, bag of coals. People behind her started to yell, Therese, her name was Teresa. Therese, they call her. Therese, your head is on fire. She takes this bag of coal and she throws it into a cane field, goes the story. and the cane field is dry, it lights up. And the cane is owned by some white colonial master. And it burns the man's fields down. And he comes to my grandfather, of course, for compensation for his field. Well, I don't know that part of the story, what he actually did. But the name of my mother, and I like to draw attention, they call her Therese. Her name was Teresa, Adora Teresa, but they call her Therese. And from then on, they call her Therese Bondon, burned down, because she burned down this master's cane field.
Her story is etched in the history. Yes. Of your country.
And I like to begin when people ask me like the question, where did you get social work? How did you come that in that colonial period? Not only in terms of the burning is symbolic, but what is important in that period and throughout my life growing up is that there's always a community of people behind you shouting out behind you, your head is on fire. Our head is on fire. Right? And then the act of throwing that bundle into the cane field is an act for me of not just the cane field, but I take it this is an act of resistance against her having to carry this bundle of cane, of coals to the market. And behind her, if you could picture this, I picture this all the time, of the people who are saying, carry it. And then it comes out of that, they name her Teresa moves from Teresa to Therese Bondon. I like to start when you ask me, where did I start my social work journey? I grew up with this woman, my mother. A resistance from small, from young, and also teaching us the importance of, if you see something, your head is alight on fire, you know, you throw it off. You throw it off. You don't keep it. You don't keep that fire burning on your head. You throw it off. And there are people behind you who are going to be supportive about you, okay?
And throwing that burning pile off of your head in itself is resistance.
It's resistance. Plus. That's right. That's right.
And
that's right.
To some degree, on Speak Up International, we seek to inspire, to inform, to educate. But believe it or not, it's resistance. We're telling our stories. Right. We're telling how we build our community. And that takes me now to your involvement in our community. Talk to us about your involvement in community development generally.
Okay. So if I were to just locate it in, say, in Toronto, I would say that community development begins as I come to Toronto. I came here in 1969. Not aware of the history of Blacks in Canada or much about the Blacks in the United States, but very quickly that you came here, the impact of racism in terms of access to housing, particularly or jobs, hits you across your face and you're at sea, not knowing what is this? Why can't I get why can't I do as other people? I go looking for a house, an apartment, and the person says, yes, come. I have a room. And when you get to the door, you see the peephole, somebody looks through, and then they never open the door. And you can't make sense of why this is happening. Why? What is this? And then you join with other Black people who have been there before, particularly African Canadians who belong to the UNIA at the time, United Negro Improvement Association. I think that's the first organization I joined. And you had, again, women like my mother, who are the backbone of this organization, the men in the forefront, and they now begin the education. Oh, this is what this means. You didn't get that apartment. You didn't get that particular thing. They have a longer history of living in Canada and understand this issue called racism, right? I come, yes, not that it didn't exist in my country, but the way it's existing there is very different from the blatant interface racism that you get. You go looking for an apartment, they'll peep through the hole and you don't get it. You want to move up to in the job that you're doing. I got a job. And I realized immediately that any promotion here, they're just about four Black women in a sea. And we can't get to move up. And you at the time, you're understanding this, but you're not verbose enough or bold enough to speak out against it. And the way that I begin to take this on is then I got to get a higher education. I got to go back to school. So I start going to York University. I first went to George Brown College, and I did a two-year course in drug addiction counseling. And and again, I give credence to one of the instructors there, a guy by the name of Bill Vine, who said to me, you should go to university. He said, you should go. And so off I went. And then side by side with going to university, I meet now a whole group of people from all over, Black people from Africa, from the Caribbean, different countries, from the U.S. We have a Black students organization. And the consciousness then begins to, this is what it is. You don't understand racism. You don't know what this is. And we learn about, we have leaders who begin to really teach us. And this is happening right in the midst of what we call that colonial struggle, anti-colonial struggle in the Caribbean and in Africa in particular. So we are joined to a Pan-Africanist movement, if you will, from Toronto. We are now with an organization tied to an organization in the United States, the African Liberation Support Committee, if you never heard of it. And that was a movement where you had Amiri Baraka, for instance, was a leader in that. We're all part of that, supporting the struggles against colonialism in Africa, and particularly the anti-apartheid struggle. So from Toronto, we have a movement here. We're linked to the Caribbean, and we're linked to the United States, and we have a Pan-Africanist view of change.
Networking is a powerful thing. It creates movements. Mm-hmm. I want to go back to something that your friend said to you, which was education.
Yeah.
And I want you to describe some of the courses that you taught at Ryerson University, and why were these courses so important to social work education?
Yeah. Now, remember that this is a profession. Social work is a North American profession. Not that it doesn't exist all over the world. It does. But here, the curriculum that we have is grounded in social work theories, social work practices. And this is very much coming out of colonialism in, say, coming from England, coming from the United States, coming from here. And so this is the core of the curriculum, is to teach the helping profession, how to help individuals, groups, families. That's social work, right? And how, by virtue of that help, then you expand it to changing structures and so on in the society. So when I started to do social work or teach social work, it is from those particular texts. It is, the curriculum is passed by the Canadian Associations of Schools of Social Work. And it also is in line with the International Associations of Schools of Social Work. Now, what is interesting about these four organizations is if trying to insert, for instance, an anti-racism focus to the curriculum took a lot of struggle, not begun by me, but began by other Black individuals. And I wish I could remember the woman who was from the United States, she taught at McGill. And she was always trying to fight to make the curriculum broaden its scope from a Eurocentric or Canadian or American focus to be embracing of other countries. And to some extent, she won, not at a cost to herself, because today when I ask about her, nobody seems to know where she's gone to. But like that, in every area that I have been, whether it is in the social work field or whether it is working in government, doing clerical work, whether it is trying to make changes in the school system broadly for Black students, yeah, everything for us always, for me, has been a struggle. It's never just an easy kind of, and it could be easy if you just accept. If you accept the curriculum, if you accept the process, if you accept the outcome, then what we're doing is really accepting that we are marginal.
Accepting status quo. We are not a people.
So the struggle has been in any institution that we are interacting with, this struggle for change, this struggle to say, why do we want this change? Because we are excluded. And why are we excluded if not? It is because we do not fit the stereotype. We do not fit the norm. We fit a stereotype, but we don't normally fit the norm. So there, any institution, for me, working in government, in the school system, teaching, and the school system, let me tell you, is a hard one to deal with because I'm a single parent, and having to deal with the school system with my son was an uphill kind of climb.
Quite a challenge.
Yes. And it's not just me. So we have a number of parent organizations, like OPPC, Organization of Parents of Black Children, led by, she just
started
passed.
By Karen Braithwaite. Started by Karen
Braithwaite. Yeah. The organizations, they're the backbone. They have to be the backbone of any kind of institutional change that you want in a society that where race is so indelible. It's so deep. And if you walk in, I walk in and I look around and I say, and after a while, we are not represented. Something is amiss.
Something is amiss. Dr. Benjamin, you've alluded to anti-racist approach in education, the curriculum. Now, people are beginning now to become familiar with the concept of equity and anti-oppression. What was the climate like when you started this kind of work?
And let me be correcting here. There hasn't been a time in the history of Blacks in this country, at no time, from the time that they landed here, from the time that they came through the Underground Railroad, from the time that they came from where, there has not been a time, two institutions that we pay attention to. One is education, the other one is religion. They have always had their own churches. They have always specified, in particularly in those churches, a way of bringing community and building community. But the other thing that I noticed too, there has been not a time in any community here where a focus has not been on our children and the educational systems that really channel our children in particular, wittingly or unwittingly, channeling our children, particularly in the jails are full, for instance. We had a program that we would go to West Detention Center or East Detention Center, and you go and it's the young men that you see in large numbers. I tell the story about an elder Jamaican man who ran a program here, Daddy Lou, ran a program here for young men off the streets. And they would come and we would teach reading and all of those basic kinds of skills, help them to get a job. And then one year, I noticed that, wait a minute, the numbers have fallen off significantly and they're not attending. And then we had a program out in one of the detention centers in Ontario. And we would go there, Dudley Laws headed up that program, and we would go to do a visitation program at the detention center. And lo and behold, when I went to that, I was amazed that the majority of young Black males that are in the detention centers, and that's been a pattern up to today, right? So when we talk about looking at the issue of race, for me, it's not simply what Akua Benjamin focused on or did or what have you, because my point is there has not been a time in this country when you cannot find a Black organization talking about these issues, education in particularly, the incarceration, the marginalization, the lack of access sometimes to quality housing, the large numbers of Blacks that we see as homeless people in this country. You don't have to just talk to me, just scan, and you would find that there is an organization trying to make change. And that's the thing that, you know, like I talk about conceptually, resistance is in our DNA. I go to that point. I say biologically, I can't prove it, but biologically, I argue that resistance is, you would not be, and I like to tell my students, whether they're white or Black, when your parents, your grandparents landed here in Canada, remember, a lot of whites came here. This is Aboriginal territory that we're on. When they came here, how did they survive? And a lot of times how they survived was because of resistance to the cold, to what have you. But they were assisted in large measure by Aboriginal communities. They were assisted. In the Black community in Toronto, we have also worked with Aboriginal communities. Vern Harper, one of the leaders in the Aboriginal community, would join with us in marches, and we would join with them. Wandering Spirit Survival School, we were there in terms of, so that the struggle that we see for equity, equality, change, against racism, we've always extended it, not simply from an anti-Black racism perspective, but looking generally at how this issue, this ideology, these practices, how they include some and they marginalize others. And the others, quote unquote, the Black community in its organizing efforts has always reached out to those that we see as well as they're part and parcel of our struggle.
We talked about the power of networking. Then you have social work, which adds to that power. How do you see those two pieces working together in order to alleviate some of the challenges and concerns that you have described?
Now, I also, you hear me talk about resistance, and I say it's in our DNA. I say every human being has that, and that you have to resist the conditions of oppression or climatic conditions or what, but you have that in you. It's how you use it, right? But the other thing, the other concept that I use, I want people to understand, is the dialectics. It comes from an old Marxist understanding. And what it means is the unity and struggle of opposites. The unity and struggle of opposites. So at one point, that dialectic says, we conform, we build laws, we support. On the other side of that dialectic is the struggle. And you can't do one without the other. At some point, you cannot just say, I will follow the laws, I will follow the rules. You have to do that. But on the other side, those laws and rules and what have you need changing in an equitable, balanced way so that everybody moves forward. Not some move forward and some move backward and some fill the jails and some fill the universities. No. We're seeing too much of that now. We're seeing too much marginalization of Black youth, particularly young Black male in those prisons. It's not balanced, right? So I teach in social work. This is an old Marxist concept that I learned from some of the Marxists who were ahead of me. One of them, I understand, has just passed. He taught me up at York, John Saul, who supported the struggles in Angola and Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau and those places, and brought that into the classroom so that my understanding of struggle was not simply what was happening here in Toronto or in Canada or in the States, but to look at it in a dialectical way to see how these struggles, how they build and how they wane at times. John Saul, take my hat off him. I understand he just passed. I want to pay tribute to him because he was major in my understanding. The community members here, the Black community members, I really want to pay attention to them as well, pay tribute, because they taught me what it meant to live in Canada. Black women, Mrs. Searles, Mrs. Brathwaite, all of those women who have since long gone, they taught me that yes, you have to work, you have to, but there's a struggle that you have to engage in all the time. And that's something I want to pass on in my teachings and in my writings. I write about anti-Black racism. Anti-Black racism is what, I didn't make up that. There was a writer in the States who I think also wrote on this, used the concept. So I draw from those, but I wrote it in my thesis, anti-Black racism. And I'm really happy to hear when people say that they use that concept because they're bringing that whole struggle, that history, that resistance right in the forefront of whatever it is that they're doing. That's what anti-Black racism should mean, that there is a resistance. There is a resistance. Yes, we look for the resilience, but what you should know is that we do not move forward in no epoch, in no era without resistance. And that we can't be quiet. We can't afford to just not say anything.
As you were mentioning the community leaders, whose shoulders we are standing on.
Yes.
I was thinking of the statement or the story you told about your mother, and you said there's always a community of people shouting that your head is on fire. And I will never forget that. That will be indelibly marked in my mind. Now, you were the director of the School of Social Work at the post-secondary institution. What was that experience like for you?
Again, I take a dialectical approach to talking about this, right? Because when the faculty said to me, Akua, you should be our next director, I said, no, I decline. I don't want to do this. And then again, I go back to, I dreamt, and I don't normally dream, that I was walking over a bridge. I'll tell you this story quickly. I'm walking over a bridge. And when I got to the middle of the bridge, there was water below me. And somebody said to me, you got to jump. You got to take the plunge. And I said, I can't swim. And they said, it's okay. I will be with you. And I dove into the water and I started swimming. And who do you think was next to me swimming?
Your mother.
My mother, who was swimming next to me. And when we reached a particular point, she said there was a row of lights ahead. Says, look, there are lights up ahead. I don't dream a lot and I don't dream often. But that one, I woke up the next day and I said, if I didn't get a message before, let me tell you, I got a clear one. I called my sister, who is a pastor minister. She teaches theology in the States at a university. And I said, Jen, guess what I dreamt? She said, you got a message. You got to take the plunge. And the lights are ahead of you. And we call my mother Mommy. And she says, Mommy is right there with you going. She says, you got to take the plunge.
You were braver than me because I was offered a similar position in nursing in Peterborough. And I was too scared to take it on. I thought they're not going to support me in that role. And I ran to Toronto.
And I had faculty who supported me, who urged me on. I'll never forget them because without them, it would have made my life much more difficult than it was. I did have opposition, and not everybody gets that, but I had a wonderful set of people who, one faculty member from India in particular, she said, I'm going to be your assistant. I'll come. She took on that role. And the previous director also stood with me. So I had support. I had opposition, as everybody would. But I think I came into the school as a director with a tremendous amount of support. The person who brought me into social work, I used to work at the hospital. And he said to me, after I would take the students on and I would teach students in the hospital about social work. He said to me, why don't you teach? Why don't you come and teach? And I said, no, I don't want to teach. I was resistant. And again, every time that I'm resistant to something, I don't like to dream. But up comes somebody in my dream to tell me, yeah, you need to do this. And I could count on one hand, maybe the number of times, because I hate to dream. Because when you dream, you're not sleepy. They say you remember your dream. You dream every night. But if you remember the dream, it means you're not sleeping. So I don't really like to dream. But when I do, sometimes it is so significant, right? What I'm saying to you is my journey here. I've always been accompanied, if not physically, by community members. I'm not if always with community members. I also have this background of these dreams or these people who show up, like some relative will show up to tell me, this is the path that you should. It doesn't happen often, but it does happen.
You talk about support, and I'm wondering, is that support multiracial?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. For instance, the person who led me to say, go to university, Bill Vine was his name, white man who taught, I would say, I had the support from him. I've been part of a feminist movement, a multi-generational or multi-ethnic, multiracial, and I still have people from that movement who are close and close with. I've walked with people like Judy Rebick and others, Winnie Ng. We've been in all kinds of... So I'm an activist at heart. I'm an activist at heart, always seeking, supporting social justice issues, even when I don't show up. Like Aboriginal I talk about a friend who was a close Aboriginal, and she would chide me off. She would tell me, oh, like, you are party to my oppression. And I would, how could I be party to your oppression? We face colonialism and hardships and whatever, just like Aboriginal people. And then she pointed out to me, she said, yeah, but you came to this country and you could find a job. You found a job. Any of us Aboriginal folks who are here who can't find no job. And this is our country. This is our. So I had to listen. I had to listen to those voices. I had to learn those things.
How many ethnic groups have you come across that have similar struggles?
If you didn't have, there isn't an ethnic group that came to this country that did not have a struggle. Unless you were part of the upper class, right? But if you go back and you look at the people who came from Ireland, okay, their struggle and where they landed. The people who came across the Atlantic from all kinds of different backgrounds, when they came, where did they settle? You name it, you trace that. There's no history of imperialism anywhere around the world where you will not find populations of people who are in the forefront or who have struggled. And that is part of who we are as human beings. This is why I say resistance is in our DNA. This is why I tell my students in the classroom, do you know anything about your history? The Portuguese, when they came here, do you know anything about that? Do you know anything about the Italians? You have the Italian background, and it seems everything is wonderful. And do you know anything about your history? Because the teaching of struggle is not simply to recall the past. It is to really cement for you that you have a role in pushing forward your society in a way that is equitable, that is fair, that is inclusive. I belong to an organization which was the Coalition of Visible Minority Women. There were about women from about 11 different countries or 12 different countries who made up that organization. They came from all over the world. And what did we want as a coalition of visible minority? We call ourselves visible minority. What did we want as a coalition? We wanted access, equity, equality, fair treatment, not simply because we're new immigrants, and women from all over the world. The Coalition of Visible Minority Women. We made petitions to governments about our children, about communities, about racism, about sexism, about the need always to carry the banner of equity, not just equality, we said. Equity is to take into consideration our differences, but the outcome has to be, when you look at the outcome of all of these groups in our society, we must see, okay, there's equitable treatment for all, and that some are not filling the jails. Aboriginal yes. people are still the largest numbers of people in these in incarceration. Why?
The struggle continues.
Yes. Samora Machel's statement. A luta continua. The struggle continues.
So on Speak of International, we strive to inspire, educate, and inform. There's no question today, Dr. Akua Benjamin, that you're helping us to do those things with your responses. I need to know from you, was there ever a time in your life when you had to say enough?
Oh, many times. You'd like to think that it took a while for me to realize that what we were experiencing was racism, right? Because you came, although you know it, but you didn't have a name for it. Like, why didn't I get that job or that apartment, or why wasn't I given the information? There are too many examples, right? And you could live your life just wailing about the examples of exclusion and difference. And yes, you have to point that out, but that's not where it begins and ends. That's not like when I see us marching in the streets, waving banners, talking about that. We got to a point in our struggle of saying, now we got it. Now it exploded. It's always been there, but now we have to make it more public. But the day-to-day denial of access, of equitable treatment, of watching that, why didn't your son go into this classroom instead of that? I remember going to a school. I would go to social work students in practice. So you have to supervise them. And you meet with the student and you met with whoever was helping, working with the student in the practice. And when I would go to many of the schools, here is in the outside of the principal's office, a lineup of young Black boys. They couldn't be more than 12, 14 years of age. I went to one school and I was distressed. Why all these black boys standing outside of the principal's office? What does this mean? This is the beginning of their way out the door of education. It is those systems of practice. And now the principals will say there was a behavioral issue here or didn't do the work or what have you. But would this outside of the principal's office, is this going to help? No, those principals then have to work with community agencies, black community agencies, with parents, with other teachers to say, how do we address this issue? And the point is, sometimes we wait until there is a crisis, there is an issue that hits the newspaper, and then everybody moves. No, you can't wait for that. You got to know that, yes, in our systems, what we have is that systems which people will say they weren't designed in that way, but that's been the impact or the outcome, where you have some groups of people who are moving forward and then you watch others who are not there. Ask the fundamental systemic question, right? When I see who comes to social work, for instance, I ask the systemic questions, at least in the short time that it was asked. Why is it that we have people who are coming from particular groups coming into social work in larger numbers, and the engineering students look differently? The students who are going into the technology field, that we have such tiny numbers of students, black students.
How can we use social work to drive away racism?
Here's my thing. I tell social workers, I say that work, the social, you got to work it. You can't just say social work. You got to work the social. Meaning that when a parent shows up in front of you or somebody who comes to you in an agency, remember, there's a systemic issue why that person showed up. That person doesn't go to Mr. Trudeau or whoever is the leader, the political leaders. They come to you. But when they come to you, they come with a history, a background of lack of access, of lack of care, of inequitable treatment. And then you, the social worker, are supposed to answer not only the individual problem. Remember that it's a systemic root to this problem. So I don't want you just to be thinking, which is what social work does most of the time, I've got to help the poor. I've got to help, you know, the homeless. You have to do those things. But if your work isn't tied to changing some system that reduces the homeless and the poor, then what we call in Trinidad, spinning top in mud. A top was a plaything that we had, and you'd pull a string and then it would spin, right? Now, if you threw that in mud, the top couldn't spin. The top would not spin. You have to throw it on level ground in order for it to spin. So what you're doing, I go back to all these Trinidad idioms. I say that you're spinning top in mud. It's going nowhere. The poor top cannot spin. I don't know if you know this toy. It's a toy that we had that you pull a string and.
Yes, I'm very familiar.
Okay.
Very familiar with it.
So I'm sorry. I come from that background of being very anecdotal. And if not anecdotal, I go back to where does all this come from? These idioms and these parables and these stories that I can, where they come from, each one of us who come out of a history of slavery. You have it in you.
Dr. Akua Benjamin.
Yeah. Right.
The woman who is an educator, the woman who's a social activist, the woman who's a community builder, the woman who was an administrator at a post-secondary education. How do you maintain your well-being?
I can't maintain it by myself. I didn't come here by myself. I don't maintain my life by myself. Okay? My community. Or communities are very important to me, very important. So I'm always, even if I'm not on the street anymore, I'm attached to some organization, some group of women, some group of Black activists trying to do something to widen our understanding. Now that I'm retired, I'm less active in that sense. I belong to, for instance, the Caribbean Association of Black Educators. I belong to that CABE at one point. The Congress of Black Women, I belong to that organization for many years. The Coalition of Visible Minority Women, the one that that people look at in bad seed, Black Action Defense Committee. I was key in that organization. These days, I'm not as active But at no time have I been without the support, the guidance, the history, learning all the time about from others how to see a struggle, how to deal with a particular kind of issue, how to be inclusive, how to be always to be inclusive, always to be respectful of other people's history and their struggles and as well, and how to conjoin those. Sometimes we need to go it alone, but a lot of times we can't make it alone. We have to always, we always have to see how does my struggle. Because sometimes when you take a position on one thing, it could be at the detriment of another group. And so one always has to, you know, in this society or in many societies, how do we be as inclusive and as respectful as we possibly can? So our door, my door is always, like, I'm always learning. I'm always willing to hear another group, its stories, its history, its struggles, and to see, oh. And sometimes it's not, sometimes it's an individual who takes a stance that is in support of moving a struggle forward. But you can't live in you can't live in these societies without knowing, maybe it's human societies, that we've moved from primitive communalism where we began right up to the most advanced societies in the world. How did that come about? How did you have hunters and gatherers moving through, building pyramids and building societies to what we have today? So the struggle is never just, it broadens, it widens. But I really want you to, I really want us to be careful. And I want people to understand the unity and struggle of opposites. That dialectic, at one point you are for something, another moment, it changes on you and you're against it. That's unity and struggle of opposites. And that you expect that. You expect that the struggle goes up, it comes mm-hmm. down, it goes sideways, mm-hmm. but it keeps moving.
Continues to be a struggle. It's dynamic.
Yes, Alut, the struggle continues.
Dr. Benjamin, this conversation has been very stimulating. And you have definitely broadened my perspectives in terms of it takes more than one group of individuals to make change. And sometimes the necessary groups have to come together and do a push in order to get something ahead. So I've learned a lot about social workers, social programs, and how you use them in order to fight racism. And I want to thank you so much for the opportunity of being able to talk to you today. And I am definitely looking forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Brown. Thank you, Brother Elton.
If you'd like to come back, just whip me an email or a text, and I would be more than delighted, because I know we haven't scratched the sand on half of what you could talk about. So I really appreciate your generosity.
Thank you for this work that you're doing. Keep Aluta continua. Samora Michelle's words, the struggle continues.
Thank you for listening to Speak Up! Exclamation Point International. If you would like to contact Dr. Akua Benjamin, kindly provide your name and email address and send it to info@speakuppodcast.ca. Please state in your email that you wish to contact Dr. Akua Benjamin. Would you like to be interviewed on Speak Up! Exclamation Point International? Please drop us a line containing your name, company name, the service you provide to your community, and email address to info@speakuppodcast.ca. You can reach us using Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. To connect to our podcast, use Spotify or your favorite podcast platform and search for Speak Up! Exclamation Point International. You can also find our podcast using our web address, www.speakuppodcast.ca. Our logo has the woman with her finger pointing up, mouth open, speaking up. At Speak Up! Exclamation Point International, we aim to inspire, to inform, and to educate.